Last week, where the class ended was that I have to sit in a different way because we have a studio audience here. So I have to get inspired by the studio audience. So we have to. Yeah. So now you get to see a window behind me, which is not. Anyway. Like this. So I was listening to the lecture I gave last week to remember where we ended up. And we ended up, what we were discussing was that when Prabhupada left, we thought that whoever's going to be guru will be guru just as Prabhupada was. So Prabhupada had daily guru puja. Prabhupada sat on the big seat. Prabhupada was served with intense love and devotion, which manifested in things such as limousines, beautiful rooms, and so on and so forth. So we kind of did the same thing, or we thought we should do the same thing for Prabhupada's disciples who became gurus. And so that's how it all started. And that didn't work, and it disenfranchised a lot of God brothers who all along didn't think it was going to work. And so it was bad, but the thing that really created the problem was that some of these gurus were found not to be following the regular principles or chanting their rounds. So that was like the straw that broke the camel's back. The people knew something was wrong. Like that this isn't right that a God brother should have such an exalted position over the other God brothers. Especially when, and then be worshipped like he's from another universe when we all know we're all from the same universe. So it minimized the position of Siksha Guru and then maximized the position of Diksha Guru. And as I was saying, in Prabhupada's time, the word Siksha Guru wasn't even used. Nobody even understood it. Nobody. I mean, it was manifested a little bit, perhaps, in relationships with sannyasis, but at the same time, we're all God brothers, God sisters. So the concept of Siksha Guru never really entered. So we only knew Diksha Guru, and so Guru meant Diksha Guru, and so when our God brothers became Guru, they just did it like Prabhupada. So then a lot of people had problems with that because it didn't seem that, because they weren't Prabhupada, it didn't seem correct that they should have this exalted position. But it was hard to communicate that because nobody understood, because we only understood Guru means, you know, this is what it says, Sakshad Hari, just like God, worship him like God, and that's how we did with Prabhupada. So basically did the same thing. For example, when it would be time to greet the deities, if the Guru was late, the deity greeting would be late. You would just wait for him to open the curtain. So now God brothers are looking at this and saying, no, you have to open the curtain at 7:15. If the Guru comes at 7:20, you just open at 7:15. You can't do that. Well, maybe with Prabhupada you might. So you had things like this, you know, which, you know, chanting of the names of the Guru in the temple, as I mentioned, Guru Pujas for the Guru, and if the God brothers didn't go, sometimes you were made to feel like you were envious, pressured to go. And big Vyas Pujas, that ended up being bigger than Prabhupada's Vyas Puja, things like that. You know, when the Guru would have nice quarters, you may not have such nice quarters. So I can tell you my personal realization, which number one is, when Prabhupada left, everybody was devastated, number one. So, and nobody was ever thinking of ISKCON without Prabhupada. So nobody thought forward of what it would be like without Prabhupada, because nobody wanted to think what it would be like without Prabhupada. And nobody could even think that there would be ISKCON without Prabhupada, so nobody thought of it. So when Prabhupada left, it was really that no one had really thought of it. And when the Guru started initiating, they initiated with an understanding which was going to transform over the next 30 years. So the way they started made it extremely difficult for them, because they were kind of replacing Prabhupada, and everybody had that hope that they would be like Prabhupada. And last night I had a really interesting conversation with a devotee who was married to Prabhupada's granddaughter, which means Prabhupada's son is his father-in-law. So that means he's part of Prabhupada's family. And he asked his father-in-law, "Why you never joined ISKCON?" He said, "Because I'm Prabhupada's son. If I join, everyone will expect me to be like another Prabhupada." He said, "And I'm not another Prabhupada. And I never will be, and it would be awkward for me and awkward for you." So when these gurus took over after Prabhupada left, there were a lot of misconceptions, such as maybe there's only going to be 11 or 15 gurus in ISKCON. There's never going to be more. And maybe these people had got all of Prabhupada's mercy and Shakti and nobody else did. And so they were immediately elevated by being given that position. And there was really a misunderstanding there, that Prabhupada didn't really give them the position, the sole position. What Prabhupada said repeatedly when he was asked who will be guru, he said, "Who's ever qualified? All my disciples." It was never like 11 or 9 or 15. It was whoever. Just like you, when your spiritual master leaves, technically you could accept disciples. So you're sitting here thinking, "No way, I'll never accept disciples." Just as when Prabhupada was here, we were also thinking, "Well, we can't be guru. We're just rank and file devotees, right? We're just, you know, I'm just a, you know, an ordinary person from Mexico. I'm just an ordinary person from California who've done ordinary things all their life. And a few years ago, I became a devotee." So there's no question. So that's how you're thinking, which is how we were thinking. And that's how most of the movement thinks. Now, what's really interesting is that Prabhupada said many, 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 many times, "You'll all have to become guru." And it was like, boop, boop. It was like, that didn't make any sense. You know, here's Prabhupada, and here's us. And, you know, we've been devotees 6 months a year, and he's telling us you have to become guru. Well, a year ago, what were we doing? Right? Just ordinary activity, or worse than ordinary. Very sinful, right? So, and I was at a lecture in a temple a couple of years ago. They were broadcasting a Prabhupada lecture, and he gave a lecture where he said, "You'll all have to become guru." And I looked at everyone when they said that, and I could see that it didn't register with not one person in that room. It just didn't make any sense. They're disciples, I think, mostly Radhanaswami. So they're thinking, Radhanaswami is guru, I'm his disciple. There's a universe of difference between us. Where's the question of me being guru? I could see when Prabhupada said that, it was like everyone just blanked. They didn't even like. And if I asked anybody, "Did you hear that?" You know, like a week later, "Did you hear that Prabhupada said in this lecture, you'll have to be guru?" I could guarantee you, nobody would say. They would say, "Did he say that? I didn't hear that." I can guarantee you, it was just like, you know what I'm saying? If something doesn't make sense, it doesn't go in your head. It blanks. So Prabhupada was saying that all along. You will have to become guru. And the reality is, if you study what Prabhupada said, you could see that he was training every one of his disciples to be guru. That's actually what he was doing. If you look at everything he said about being guru, you will come to the conclusion that from day one he was training all of us to be guru, because he knew he wasn't going to be here that long. I mean, he came here at 70. So now I have godbrothers, maybe five or six, who have died in the last 5 years, all in their 60s. Right? So even us in our 60s, where, you know, normally you don't die in your 60s, at least, you know, you get in your... So even us, we're starting to think, well, now I have a godbrother, he's in the hospital. He's been, you know, so you're thinking, well, now it's 60s, you know, for whatever reason, you know. too much halva, I don't know, too much ghee or whatever. So the guru has to think, all right, I have to train my disciples how to be guru. Maybe they'll be qualified, maybe they won't. At least six are guru. So that was Prabhupada's mood. He was training everybody to be guru. Right from the beginning, you might say, really? Yeah, but you look at what he said. You'll all have to become guru. By 1975, I hope you all be guru. Everyone will inherit the title Bhaktivedanta. Where, you know, it's like there are many, 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 many quotes, and you're sitting there thinking, no way. I'm not going to be a guru. I'm just, you know. No, but you'll be guru for your children. And then you'll be guru for the new bhaktins. And then when you're 60, and, you know, when you're 60, there's going to be thousands of people joining ISKCON who are 20. And they're going to look at you and they're going to go, you're my guru, because you have 40 years of realizations. It's inevitable whether you accept it or not. But so my point is that was Prabhupada's mission. He was training right from the beginning. That's what he was doing, because it had to go on without him, and he didn't know how long he was going to live, and he'd already had heart attacks and strokes. So he would often say, I could die at any moment. And so he was training us, you go on. He said, everything I need to teach you is in the first canto. So he didn't, you know, he wasn't worried that he hadn't taught us enough. So, what was the point I was making before this? So then, Prabhupada was training all of us, but after Prabhupada left, then there was 11 who we thought, well, maybe these are like the only 11, you know, in the universe that ever be guru, or something like that. It's these 11 there, you know, they're the 11 chosen ones. The Shakti has descended. So now they're doing their service, they're empowered, they're great devotees, they're great preachers. No doubt about it. Nobody ever minimized their position. So some devotees are fine with this. They're like, great, these are our God brothers, these are the most advanced devotees, these were Prabhupada chose people who were on the front lines of preaching. These, you know, that's how he chose guru, by who was preaching, who was out there. So for some people it was fine, and for other people they immediately were like, no, there's something wrong. So personally, what I can say, and I think this represents how a lot of devotees were feeling, is that I couldn't philosophically understand how the position of our God brothers as guru is not different than Prabhupada's position. I couldn't go to the Shastra and find anything and said, well, here's a guru who's a disciple of an eternally liberated soul, so he's a guru like this. It wasn't really clear in Shastra, because the Shastra just talks about guru. Guru is Krishna. Krishna is a guru. The one who represents Krishna is the guru. So the guru is not actually that person, but he's Krishna. And Krishna comes to you through that person. Like we say, the guru is the external manifestation of Supersoul. So you have the Supersoul inside and Supersoul outside. So now your guru is like the external Supersoul. But that guru comes in a form. And there'll be many people who can be the external manifestation for you in different bodies. But what are they representing? They're representing Krishna. So that's what the Shastra said. So if he represents Krishna, then you honor him as Krishna, because he's like the king is representing God. You honor the king like God. So it just seemed homogeneous that anyone who takes the position of guru, is just, they take it the same way. So we couldn't really philosophically understand or establish that our God brothers would be, their being guru would be any different than Prabhupada being guru. Although we understood they were different. Obviously, they were different. But there was, for me, as soon as the local guru where I was, that when Prabhupada left, I was in San Diego. And I remember going to Los Angeles in the local, and they'd built a Vyasasan, which was just slight, maybe like this much lower than Prabhupada's. And then it's basically the same size. And then when he sat on that seat, nothing was in my head, it was all in my heart, and I had this intense feeling like something is really wrong with this. He shouldn't be sitting there. I couldn't philosophize it, because based on our books, it said, you know, guru, you worship the guru this way, you honor him, you take care, you do all these things. It was like, okay, I can't from Shastra say that what you're doing is wrong. But from the point of view of how I felt when I saw that, it was, you know how sometimes you understand with your head and sometimes you understand with your heart, and then your heart talks to your head. So my heart said, this is not right, but my head couldn't establish. You understand? There was no, I couldn't, because everything I read in the Shastras, it was the Guru's representative of God, should be worshipped like God, and that's how we worship Prabhupada. So we didn't have enough tradition and experience and understanding of the philosophy to say, look, this is wrong. So there were a lot of devotees feeling the way I was feeling. And another thing is we saw alienation going on with a lot of God brothers, because they weren't supporting this. And if you weren't supporting it, then you're an outcast. Look, you're in the temple, you're in the zone, you have to support this, because it's disunified if you don't. And I have disciples here. And if you don't support this, then the disciples are going to lose faith, because, right? You understand? So it was like you had both of these things, and those points are all true. They're definitely true. But the way it manifests with the group, daily group, which is the big seats, and the kind of honor that went to the Diksha Guru, and the without any recognition of what a Siksha Guru is, and the position of God brothers and God sisters also, who are equally as powerful and knowledgeable as your Diksha Guru, that wasn't there. So it was out of balance. So it wasn't wrong to worship Guru and honor Guru, but it wasn't balanced on the other side, and it was, the worship went too far. So a lot of people felt bad, a lot of people spoke against it, but it was falling on deaf ears, because the other side was saying, look, this is how Prabhupada did it, and you're just envious. That was basically the argument, you know. Which is, you know, I guess when you don't have an argument, that's what you say. You say, you're just envious. So anyway, so what happened if some people, they just couldn't stay in ISKCON, and they started going out, or they go into other Gaudiya Math gurus and ask them, well, you know, how did you do this in the Gaudiya Math? And so we started learning at the Gaudiya Math, they never had Guru Puja. That was just something introduced in ISKCON, to have a daily Guru Puja. They don't do that, and they don't have big seats for their gurus. Maybe Vyas Puja, there's a big seat, but otherwise, he said, you know, the guru just sits on the asana that everyone gives class, and then basically their asanas were cushions on the ground. You know, we had it different. You know, we had this like whole different system going on. So that information started filtering into ISKCON, and people were saying, yeah, that makes sense, because it brings everyone more to the same level. Because you have to understand, at that time in ISKCON, more devotees were Prabhupada disciples than were not. Like, you're thinking, how many Prabhupada disciples have you even met in your life? Like 30 or something? Yeah. When Prabhupada left, there were 5,000. Everybody was Prabhupada disciple. So, you know, in the years after Prabhupada left, it was mostly Prabhupada disciples. New people were coming, slowly, slowly getting initiated, but you mostly had Prabhupada disciples. So it's really awkward to have your godbrother up here and everybody down here. Basically, you were almost on the level of their disciples, although they didn't treat you that way in most cases, but some did. A few did. They just thought they were, you know, better or empowered, or now the new via media to Prabhupada is me. So there was a lot of misunderstandings. So we're learning from Gaudiya Math a few things, that this is not how Guru was worshipped. And the way your Prabhupada was worshipped was a new precedent that you set. And they never said there was anything wrong with that. But they said, in general, as far as you are concerned, you know, you have many, many gurus, and it's just you, God brothers like that. You keep it down to earth. So that made sense to a lot of people. But as far as the gurus and the GBC, they weren't buying into that so much. Right? So then one guru had some trouble, maybe 1979, I forget the year, one guru had some trouble. It was found that he was taking drugs, and he had addicted to cocaine or something. Right? Then he was still, you know, a guru. And then he was in his kind of madness of being drugged, he was doing weird things, not acting normally. So they had to deal with that. They had to remove him from his own. I don't exactly remember what happened. Then, 1981, I believe it was. Joseph Prabhupada left in 77. The first guru started initiating in 78. So now we're talking just a couple of years after Prabhupada left. And these devotees who were in this position were, you know, the leading people in our movement. Never had any trouble. Just, you know, people, everyone respected. People were empowered. People were doing tremendous service. And then the next one is found. He was taking drugs also. He was experimenting with LSD. But the first one wasn't advocating the use of drugs, but the second one was. He said, this LSD is the dust of Radharani's feet. So it really... And then he was exhibiting externally so-called ecstatic symptoms. So it was a real... It became crazy. You know, he was on the Vyasa Sun screaming, and you know, he was on LSD, and he was, Radhe, ah! So this was like, okay, you know, we know that they're not up here and we're down here, but now they're below us. You know, it's like, so then devotees started thinking, okay, our hunch that they're too high is now coming true. They can't take that. They're not meant to be in this position of adoration. It's too high. Nobody, no human, other than an eternally liberated soul or a perfect being, is going to be able to accept this position. It just, you won't be able to deal with it. It's, you know. But it, too, it still wasn't enough. It was like, they were still holding on to it. And just, you know, they were like, no, this is the position of guru, and don't break the faith of my disciples, right? So as I was saying in the last class, I think, I don't know if you were there, but I was saying in the last class, it hit a point in 1986, right? And a lot of God brothers were getting together, you know, talking about this is naturally. Could you imagine, right, if, let's say you lived in Argentina, right? And so, what would be a better example? Okay, let's say it's 40 years from now, and this is happening, you know, now the men and women could all be gurus, and you have some god sisters that are gurus, and you've known them for 40 years, and you went on Sankirtan with them, and they told you, like, every problem they ever had. So you knew they're not, and they're still confiding, you know, this is really hard service, people think I'm great, but I still hanker after, you know, chocolate cheesecake. And they're, you know, so you know where they're at, and then... But everyone's maintaining them in this high position, and you start to see indications that it seems like she's really getting attached to this guy over here. You know, you see things that are unhealthy, or, you know, I saw her coming back like at 12:30 the other night. What is she doing? You know, these are the things we're seeing. And so then what are you going to do? You're going to start talking to other god sisters and going, she's cut like... You know, I hear her coming back, and she lives in the room next to me. It's like 12:30, she's coming back. What's going on here? And, you know, half the time she's not coming to Mangalarti. So we're seeing all these things. So the God brothers are talking. So it started like this guru reform thing, like something's wrong, something's really wrong, right? But only two had fallen down. So it was like, okay, 2 out of 11, all right. So they both... And it was both drugs. It wasn't even sex, it was drugs. Which is really weird, right? Because that's not usually when devotees fall, it's not usually what they don't become drug addicts, alcoholics. It's usually they, you know, they go into grihastha, sannyasis go into grihastha life, or they have girlfriends, something like that. So now, this reform is going on, and talking, and everybody's talking, and everybody's upset. And the movement's a bit in turmoil. And a lot of the preaching is, a lot of the God brothers just, they're not preaching. They're like, why do I want to preach and bring people to this person when two just fell who knows if they're going to fall, and he's sitting on this big seat and this and that, and he's not Prabhupada, you know. So there was this, and I'm making the devotees, and then I just turn them over to him. And then another thing that would happen is, let's say I make you a devotee, right? You come, I'm in L.A., you're there, you're coming, you know, I meet you at some college, you know, you come to Sunday feast, I talk to you. That's how it normally works, right? You know, we have a relationship, and then you finally decide to become a devotee. Now, in those scenes, if I was a man, then you'd go into the woman's ashram, and then so basically our connection wouldn't be very much. If it were San Diego or something, smaller temple, might be a little more. And if it was a really small temple, it would probably be pretty close. Or let's say you're a man, it would be really close. But what would happen a lot in ISKCON is now you go into the temple, at some point you'd get connected to your guru. So our relationship is like, which was a little bit like Siksha Diksha, it just dissolves. In many cases, now you're like, this is my guru, and everyone else who brought you, you just was like, you know? That's how it was then. It was like, so it's like, you could see as a preacher that these people were kind of like your children in a sense, because you raised them, right? They're, you know, you're taking care of them. And then when they got initiated, it's kind of like, you know, your kids leave home and they never want to call you again. It wasn't always that bad. In some cases, devotees really felt a deep connection because it was long-term related. We're talking like 10, 15 years. So they realized after 10, 15 years, there was more than just their guru that was helping them. But initially, in the first few years, someone would come and then you'd get initiated and you would see all this dedication, devotion, everything just transferred. And then you, as the person who brought them to Krishna consciousness, kind of like, well, I guess that was my service to bring you. And then relationship is, you know. So we're looking at all this and thinking, is this what I want to spend the rest of my life making people who I have a great relationship with, turning them over to this person who now is coming back at midnight, who's we don't see chanting his rounds in the temple, this, that, and the next thing. So all this discussion's going on. Then it comes to a head and there's a protest, there's a revolution, there's a guru reform, this kind of thing. We can't take this anymore. And God brothers get together with many of the gurus and GBCs, and they voice their opinion, full of emotion, full of disappointment, discouragement, blame, looking at what you're doing. And right after that happened, two of the biggest gurus in ISKCON left. One we found out had got a woman pregnant, maybe just a few weeks before that meeting, or a few months before. And another one just said, I can't do this. He was a sannyasi. He said, I have to get married and just live outside. I can't do this. So this was like, okay. This was like, now this is like proof. Okay, we the guru reform, were onto something. It's this like, this is wrong. They can't do this. There's something wrong with the system. So this was 1986. Now I have to go to chat to see where everybody's at. Okay. So now we're going to go back to where I was. What was the ultimate argument that was backed by Shastra that allowed your mind to align with your heart? It didn't. I didn't have Shastra. But what we started, he's saying, you know, it's like I had this heart feeling. But it only went to the head from the heart. It didn't go from Shastra. The problem we were having, which was very difficult to deal with, and like today, probably is not really an issue for any of you. It's just normal in the culture of ISKCON. You join and you know, this is Prabhupada, and this is my guru. And Prabhupada's Prabhupada, and my guru is my guru. And it's like, it's obvious, right? And there are so many God brothers who could be of my guru, who could be my Siksha guru. And in some cases, Siksha relationships are even stronger than Diksha relationships, because you either have more in common with that person, your guru has left, or that person lives with you, or you've had a lot of association. So that became more common. Whereas in the early days, that was all taboo, so it couldn't happen. Even if it was happening, it couldn't happen, because you wouldn't let it happen, because you'd feel you're being unchaste, right? So let's say you in Mexico, you know, you're taking courses from someone, or there's some senior Mataji, and she's guiding you, and you see that this is like a Siksha relationship. In those days, you wouldn't see it that way. You'd feel like, oh, this is unchaste. So you wouldn't recognize what was happening, even though it was happening. You know? Something like that. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
It was like it wasn't, you couldn't, it was, you'd be considered wrong. It's like you were preached to that marriage is bad and you shouldn't get married. So there might be some man that you feel connected to, but you will not allow those feelings to manifest because you were told marriage is bad. So it might be like the most compatible person in the universe and a perfect relationship, but you just... Like so it was happening that way with other devotees, where you might naturally have a relationship, but you wouldn't because you think it's wrong, right? So now in ISKCON that doesn't exist. So we had to deal with how can a guru be anything other than the way Prabhupada manifested his guru? Can there be gurus who aren't uttamas? So then this whole debate, which still goes on today, is can someone be a guru if he's not uttama adhikari? Because Shastra says you have to take shelter of an uttama. But then Prabhupada says, usually a guru is eternally liberated, but there are others who are not liberated who, because they follow their guru, they can deliver the goods. Because you know, you're still delivering the goods. You deliver it in a beautiful truck, it's clean, in a nice suit, or a guy comes to you on a rickshaw and delivers it and the box is dirty, but the goods are still the same. It's a little bit like that, right? So we're thinking, no, he has to drive in a Mercedes truck and wear a suit to deliver the goods. You know, say, but Prabhu, the goods are the same. And another thing we didn't understand is say, wait a minute, maybe your guru can't deliver the goods like to train you in book distribution or deity worship or, you know, or teach you rasa tattva, you know, when you're on that level ready to hear it. But there's someone else, godbrother, that can do it. So it's a family. That's your uncle. So your uncle does it. Even they asked Prabhupada about deity worship. He said, go to my godbrother. So I didn't live in the temple. So it wasn't a problem for us. You understand? So that's more clear today. And it's going to evolve even more in that direction in ISKCON. It's not at the point yet. Now in ISKCON, it's kind of like if you're thinking of taking Diksha, you usually find out who gives Diksha, you know. It's like most devotees don't think about asking someone who doesn't give Diksha to give Diksha. They just think, yeah, do you give Diksha? Oh, I can take from you? Well, yeah, you could take from me even if I didn't, because I could, if I'm your guru, then I could get authorized, approved, not objected to, whatever, right? To do it. So some devotees don't understand you can be a grihastha, right? And I don't think there's any list, official list, where you could go and even see who's guru and who isn't. And if there is, some people, it may not be updated. So then how do you know who is guru? Well, more and more you understand, we will come to understand, you know who guru is, but who you have faith in, who you're hearing from, who you want to serve. That's where guru is. Guru is Krishna, and where Krishna comes to you, that's guru. Right? Siksha, Diksha, Vartma, Pradarshika, whatever. Krishna is manifesting to you. This person's coming to you, he's your guru. So we're evolving in that way, so that a Diksha disciple could say, oh, you know, so-and-so, he's also my guru. I have this intimate relationship. I serve him, I work with him. Or so-and-so, he's my guru. I say, well, how can he be a guru? He's not a Diksha guru. No, he is. And I asked him for Diksha, so maybe he'll. So, you know, we're evolving to that. But from the position we came after Prabhupada left, it was like, it's one guru, it's the Diksha guru, and that's it. So that's why it was hard, Prem Kishore, to make sense of it philosophically, because we didn't understand tradition, multiple gurus, we didn't understand anything about Siksha Guru. We thought these people were empowered. We thought Prabhupada appointed them. We didn't. At that point, it was like, okay, these 11, they'll start out, but within the next 5 years, we want to have 100 gurus because all of you should be doing this. It was like they held on to it, and other people wanted to do it, and they were very selective. You know, there may be 15 gurus by 1982 or something. They weren't opening it up. But were there 15 gurus in ISKCON? There were hundreds, thousands of qualified people who could do it. And that's what Prabhupada meant. He said, whoever follows the guru. Whoever can give his instructions, whoever sets the example, he can be guru. That was Prabhupada's thinking, right? So that's how it worked. That's how it was supposed to work. But they held on to it. So it was like this small clique. These are gurus, we're not. So it sent a message. These are gurus, these other guys are not. They're just God brothers. So, you know, okay. So it was more through tradition and seeing how the tradition of guru disciple works that we began to understand that they don't have to be worshipped like Prabhupada. And then I had a revelation and a realization. I had a revelization. I'll be like Shakespeare and make up words. I had a revelization. That's a good word, right? So my revelation was that the problem we had was not, at least I'll speak for myself, the problem I had was not so philosophical as it was cultural. In the West, we don't understand the culture of student-teacher. It's like, you have a teacher, you go to class, they're your teacher. When you leave class, they're not your teachers, they're just whoever, right? And there's no relationship in terms of service, as there is in Vedic culture. Your teacher, it's also, how do you learn from them? You serve them. You give them gifts, guru dakshina, right? So, you know, like, in India, whenever I've taught courses like Bhakti Shastra, anything like that, a lot of times, at the end of the course, the Indians, because they have the culture, they'll come up and give a present to the teacher, because that's the culture, whether it's money or a book or whatever. And I wanted to buy a harmonium many years ago when I was teaching. One of my students was an elderly man, and I was negotiating to buy the harmonium with another devotee, and he was in the room. And when we walked out the room, he just said, I'll buy it for you. And then I told that to another devotee, and he said, yeah, that's culture, because you were his guru for the last month, because you taught him, and that's how he thinks. So that's his guru dakshina. That's culture. So we didn't have that culture. So, you know, for us, and then there's another culture which we didn't have, and that's the culture of you honor the position no matter the qualification of the person. Just like you'll see in culture, the father's like, you know, he's a drunkard, he's this and that, but I'll get to all your questions in a minute. You know, my father, you know, he may have been in and out of jail, this and that, but he's still my father. So there's some respect for the father position. You obviously don't respect his actions, but that's culture, you know. Like Prabhupada, when he addressed any ministers, you could see his letters, you know, he addressed them according to the position. Dear respected minister of so-and-so, like that. He said, you respect, that's their position, so you respect it. So Prabhupada did that, you know. Someone was, sometimes they said, Prabhupada, these professors are puffed up. He said, they have a right to be puffed up. You know, they qualified themselves to a certain position. So that's Veda culture, that's culture anywhere in the world. You respect your teacher, you respect your mother, your father, your elder brother, your elder relatives. You respect the king, because the king is supposed to represent God, because laws come from Manu, the father of mankind, and the king is supposed to represent Manu. So therefore, that means the laws are coming from God, he represents God, so the king you honor like God. So king is called Naradev, God. So you honor the king like God, you honor your mother and father like God, you honor your teacher like God. So it says, don't become a guru, don't become a mother and father, don't become a worshipful superior unless you can deliver them. Don't become a king. Don't take any superior position unless you can deliver your dependents, right? So it's equating all of these, the guru, the teacher, the mother, the father, the king, the relative. It's equating them all in the same position. Now, who is the guru? Acharya mam vijaniya. Krishna says, I am the guru. So what does that mean? When you teach your children, you're the guru because you're Krishna. Krishna's coming through you, to your children. You're Krishna for your children. They see Krishna coming through you. Krishna's the guru. You're just representing him, right, through his teachings. So now you're guru for your... So in Vedic culture, when the kids wake up, they bow down and touch the feet of their mother. That's the culture. Mother is the first guru. That's Shastra, right? So, mother's first guru. In India, in schools, when the teacher walks into class, they stand up. Even in Muslim culture, they'll do that. Wherever there's cult, kids will stand. Probably in Mexico 100 years ago, they did that. Yeah. So, kids will stand up, right? It's the teacher. You respect the teacher, the uncle. You know, that's just culture. I was not raised with that culture. I think most of us, if we have it, it's not, it's there, but it's not obvious. So, yeah, sure, you should respect your father, but a lot of kids leave home when they're 18. They just go, forget it. Don't leave home, forget it, I'm doing what I want. Some leave when they're 15, right? That's Western culture. You know, forget my parents, what do they know, right? Oh, don't leave, who cares for you, right? So even in Vedic culture, even your parents may say something wrong and you don't follow it, but you still respect, he's my father. You know, I have to at least externally show that I respect them, but I may not follow. That's still part of the culture. Just, you know, okay, yeah, whatever you say. Now, that's why Westerners have problems in India, because in Indian culture, especially if you're a superior and a junior doesn't agree with you or thinks something wrong, in front of you, they'll just agree. They'll say, yes, yes. And we as Westerners saying, oh, you're duplicitous. Just be straightforward. If you don't agree, tell me. Said, no, they would consider that an offense, that they should respect you. So you're considering it offensive or wrong that they don't tell you, and they're considering it offensive or wrong to tell you, because that's the culture, because you're a superior. So I shouldn't do that to a superior. And then they leave and they go say, you know what he said, what Mahatma said, that's so stupid. Right? That's the culture. You understand? It's a different culture. We don't come from that culture. So then, when Prabhupada left, you know, when Prabhupada was here, he was the guru. Nobody else was the guru. So we're thinking guru is one person, or now he's 11. He went from 1 to 11. We don't understand the teacher's guru, the mother's guru, the king's guru. So Acharya Mambi Jani, I'm the Acharya, I'm the teacher. So then I began to understand, wait a minute. The problem I was having and many of us were having is we didn't understand. The teacher comes in many forms. And not only that, the king is honored like God. The mother and father are honored like God. The brother is honored. You know, it's not just that you honor the guru like God. Okay, maybe there's more specifics in there, more technicalities. But as a general principle, teacher, mother, father, king, they're all representing God, and you worship them as God. So like, then the lights went off and said, oh, okay, now I understand. It's not just that the Diksha Guru is this. So now it started to balance the playing field. Like, there are many gurus. And wherever you see Krishna, there's guru. Where Krishna comes to you, that's your guru. Right? Now, whether you want to develop an eternal relationship, temporary relationship, a three-month relationship, a counseling relationship for two sessions, right? A relationship for the rest of this life, a siksha guru or a diksha guru, that's another question. But where there's culture, they'll honor the teacher like they honor their guru. Then Prabhupada said, treat the godbrothers of the guru like your guru. Well, that didn't happen after Prabhupada left. The godbrothers were not treated like the new disciples guru. It's because we didn't understand the culture. So you have the information, but if you don't have the culture, you don't understand how to apply it. So praying for sure, I think that's how it started registering first within me. And then I could go to the Shastra and kind of adjust it and say, well, when the Shastra says this about guru, I could also apply that to teacher. I could apply that to siksha guru. I could apply that to the king. I am... Say, your guru is God. Oh, okay, your guru is God. But what does that mean? It means God's representative. Well, the king's God's representative. My mother's God's representative. My father's God. My teacher's, you see? I could. So it was like, okay, there's a guru culture within the Vedas where there's so many gurus. mother's first guru. So you learn how to worship your mother like guru. So what I find amongst Indians, like honoring others like their guru, it's just natural for them. It's not a problem. You know, you come to their house, they treat you like God. No problem. It's not. But with us, as Americans, your guru comes to your house, you treat him like God. His godbrother comes, we'll see if, you know, if we can, you know. Sorry, Maharaj, I'm really busy, you know. The vegetables are out here, you know. You could cook them yourself, kind of, you know. It's not that bad, but you understand, yeah. But if it's your guru, no. So, you know, with Indians, it's not like that. The godbrother guru comes, he gets treated just like the guru. That's part of their culture. It's not even a, you know, why should I? What did he ever do? You know. Then even people who aren't godbrothers guru, just senior devotees, they'll get treated that way. You know. It's part of the culture. So we lack that. So it was like, Diksha Guru is everything, and everybody else is just everybody else. And we still have remnants of that in our society, in some places more, in some places less. Diksha Guru is everything. Everybody else is everybody else. Kind of, you know, yeah, you're a nice devotee and you're whatever, but, you know, this is my Diksha Guru and he's God and everybody else is not God. God is only coming through him. He's not coming through anybody else. Right? No, I'm a guru for Anuradha. But I don't feel like I'm God. I'm just a devotee. But she somehow or other sees Krishna coming through me. And so there's a connection. You may not see it. That's fine. Guru is subjective. I don't see your father the way you see him. She doesn't see your father. Your father is your father. To her, it's your father. There's no connection. Right? That's why it said Guru Tat was inconceivable, because it's subjective. Like, you know, so she sees me as guru, and you're sitting there thinking, why would you see him as guru? He doesn't talk like my guru. He doesn't look like, you know what I'm saying? It's like, you know, or I don't see Prabhupada in him, you know, but it doesn't matter, you know. And then you're thinking, well, he can't be a pure devotee because, you know, he doesn't have 4,000 disciples. If he had a pure devotee, he'd have, you know, all these kinds of crazy things. Or, you know, he doesn't lead nice kirtan. Why would you ever accept him as a guru? Or, I heard his class, he didn't quote any shlokas. I can't imagine. Why would you accept anyone as a guru who doesn't quote shlokas? So this was the kind of understanding we were dealing with. And then it came to the point that some disciples thought their guru was the only guru in ISKCON. And this may, to some degree, still be going on. He is the one above others. And, or he's, you know, others might be guru, but he's the guru. And he's really the one that we should follow and the GBC should listen to. So you will still find that perhaps was stronger in the past, but I think it's eternally a problem that someone will come along and just go, this is the one. Yeah, for you he is. Okay, we don't have a problem saying, for you he's the best and he's the one. But don't think that that's the one for everybody. It's subjective. For you, it's fine. Like we say, you should find a pure devotee. You know, you should take initiation from a pure devotee. Say, well, how do you know he's a pure devotee? Where the question was asked, pure devotee, who decides he's a pure devotee? Well, you do. Maybe he's not a pure devotee for her. She doesn't see it, but you see that. And because you see that, there's faith and there's inspiration and you want to take shelter. So you can't necessarily objectify this one's a pure devotee or more pure or less pure. If he's more pure for you and you're inspired, that's fine. But don't go around saying these others aren't pure. Just realize that this is what I see in him. Right? Just like we had to deal with Prabhupada's godbrothers. We see Prabhupada in one way. They don't see him that way. They're godbrothers. It's subjective. They would sometimes criticize him. Right? So you have to adjust all these things. Yes? That makes sense? Yeah. So we didn't know all this. This was all, and we're still learning, right? So we're also learning that the guru, as Prabhupada said, the guru is one, but he manifests different forms. So the guru is Krishna. Or technically, the guru is Nityananda. He manifests the guru Shakti. So that Guru Shakti, that mercy, that Kripa, it comes through your Guru, through so many Gurus, to you. It's the same thing, but embodied in a different body. So you can see your Guru, especially in ISKCON, it's so easy to see this, because all the Gurus are disciples of Prabhupada. So there's the same books, the same philosophy, it's the same movement, same organization. So to see the Guru in many people is quite natural. But in the early days, no. My Guru is the best. No, but the Guru is Krishna, so where's the question of, right? And the other thing is, no, my Guru is better, this and that. We all have access to Prabhupada, and we all have access. You can listen to any Guru. Oh, you go on the internet, you can listen to every Guru in ISKCON, right? So what anybody knows in ISKCON, you can know, not just what your Guru knows. So it's not, your advancement is not refined to just what your Guru knows. So even if someone says, but your Guru, yeah, he's good at book distribution, but he doesn't know anything about rasa. All right, so I go to so-and-so, who knows everything about rasa. He's the god brother of my Guru. He becomes my six-year Guru on rasa. Fine, no problem. That's the way it's always worked. Your Guru, you go to your Guru and say, Guru Maharaj, can you teach me about rasa, Raghunuga Bhakti, this and that? He goes, go to so-and-so. He's the acharya in that subject. So then he goes to so-and-so. That becomes his six-year Guru. They develop a relationship. He doesn't see any difference. He says, Krishna's coming through this person to me, and I'm learning this topic. That's the tradition. Therefore, you find Bhaktivinoda Thakur. Who's his Guru? We all say, well, it's Jagannath Das Babaji, right? That's his Guru. That's where he got his instruction to take shelter. But he was initiated by Bipina Bihari Goswami. That his Diksha Guru was Bipina Bihari Goswami. But his real Guru was Jagannath Das Babaji. That's where he took most of his instruction. So that was where the person who made the most, had the most significance on his life, that was his Guru. That's who he called his Guru. Not that he disrespected his Diksha Guru, but his Siksha Guru was more prominent. Gaurkishor Das Babaji, Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Gaurkishor Das Babaji. And Prabhupada said there are many gaps in the succession, but there were these links, these strong links in relationships and where you're being influenced. So you'll see. So it's not a problem in ISKCON. It becomes a problem if you go outside of ISKCON and say, well, I have great faith in this devotee. Then there become institutional issues. Or that great devotee, because they're not within ISKCON, they may have different ways of preaching and different ways of seeing philosophy. Then you start to have problems. So ISKCON has always tried to keep everybody together. It's just a practical thing. But within ISKCON, it's one goal, one institution. And they're all brothers, and they're all serving. So it's like, it's not a problem. But in the early days, it was a problem because we thought, oh, I'm being unchaste. I'm going to another Guru. Like if this were 1978, and you were living here, and I do this class twice a week, and you came twice a week for the whole 3 months you were here, if this was 1977, your Guru would get on your case. He said, my teachings are not good enough for you. You need to go to somebody else. That's what they would say. My lectures are not good. Why are you listening to him? Why? Maybe they wouldn't, but it has been said, for sure. Those things were said. Why you need to go to someone else? Are my teachings insufficient? So now that won't happen. Now you see your Guru in so many people. You see, we're unified, right? And if somebody says something that's a little different, you just go to your Guru and say, Mahatma Prabhu said this, what do you think of it? Oh, he said that because of this, that, and that. And you're like, oh, okay, now I understand. And you see it's the same thing. So you don't have that problem. But so you understand the context, which was confusing. We had, it's like one thing you see in ISKCON is like someone can teach something, and in terms of instruction, of philosophy, it makes total sense. But then you look around ISKCON and nobody does it, and it gets confusing. Because you can't fully understand something if it's not manifested in your culture. Because you think you understand it, and you can even talk about it, but when it comes to living it or practicing it, if it's not inherent within the culture, then it's just, you don't really do it, because you live in a different way from the instruction, because that's the way the culture is. So does that make sense? we're supposed to be humble. He said, but Prabhu, I see so many devotees. You know, my temple president, he's always chastising me. He's not very humble, and he's been a devotee for 30 years. I'm like, you know, what's this whole thing about humility? Or devotees aren't always kind, and, you know, so you, or we have this whole, you know, guru culture that wasn't in line with the way it's supposed to be. So even though it says something in a book, on the ground we're doing something different, and you couldn't really, we really couldn't understand the book. So we, over the years, we had to make sense of it. And one of the ways that Krishna made sense of it to us in a way which was very clear, where there was no doubt, is that 11 of the initial, 8 of the initial gurus fell down. 8 out of 11 fell down. And one of the 3 remaining had some challenges. That broke faith in some of his disciples. So you could say 8.5 of 11. Right? And these were, as I said, what we considered our best devotees, our most advanced devotees. So then we understood, okay, they were up here. We have guru, they're up here, the God brothers are down here. It's like this. It's just a service. And we've got to bring it down to this level. And it's still coming down. It's not this way yet. It's still here because you still see siksha different than diksha. You know, if someone's not an official ISKCON guru, you see them a little different. I don't, I'm saying you, but in general, devotees do. That's still the culture. But since we brought it down, we have maybe 80 gurus, and since we brought it down, maybe 4 or 5 have had problems. But percentage-wise, that's only like 6% compared to like 80%. So, so it was easy for us to now, you know, the reform movement to say, look at, this is off, because most of them had already given up their Krishna consciousness. So I said, okay, this system is wrong. And then people started saying, we need more gurus, normal people, like that. You know, that was the idea. So that was my answer to his question. I have to read what else is here. Prem Kishore is confused. I have to go back. Oh my God, there's been a lot of discussion. I have to go back. I think I'm going back to the another day. Yeah. Hold on, everyone, till I find. Okay. What was the ultimate argument? And he says, Krishna Kirtan says, one of the first verses I learned as a new devotee was Prithivitayachi Yada Nagarati Gram Savrita Prachaho Hobe Moranam. From Chaitanya Bhagava, we were trained as preachers and teachers right from the beginning. Sent to distribute Prabhupada's books every town and village. So we were all acting as gurus. We didn't really understand that we, you know, Prabhupada expected us, even as a siksha guru, expected us to take care of people, you know, be their guru, guide them back to God. Because siksha guru is the most important. The siksha is, okay, here's an important point. Everyone, obviously this class is going a little longer, but we got to get through the questions, but it's important. What's the difference between diksha and siksha? There's an interesting explanation of this. Is that when you get initiated, you get the mantra, you get the Hare Krishna mantra, or you get your Gayatri mantras, what are called Panchatriki mantras, at second initiation. So the diksha guru gives you the mantras, and of course you make your vows to the diksha guru. But the main, you could say the main, one of the main difference in function between siksha guru and diksha guru is that the diksha guru gives you the mantras, the siksha guru doesn't give them to you. So the ceremony, the vow, all that, right? So that's diksha. Then diksha means initiation. So you're getting initiated. The person who gives you the initiation is the diksha guru. Now you have the mantra, right? And you have your whole life ahead of you. How do you chant the mantra? How do you apply it in your life? So many details are there. Whereas the diksha guru goes, here's the mantra, these are the 10 offenses, take it and go. The sixer guru gives you all the details. This is how you chant, this is how you live, this is what you do, what you don't do. So you might say, but isn't my diksha guru doing that? And in most cases, the answer is yes. Now his function is also as siksha guru. He's functioning as siksha guru to you. But if his function was only diksha guru, and there are some cases where someone only gives diksha and your siksha is given by somebody else, like all these details, then you have two very deep relationships, one with your siksha and one with your diksha. Now, in some cases, the siksha guru, the diksha guru is on the other side of the world, and you're getting more association from someone else and more guidance, and that you're getting more siksha. And that's why that relationship can become closer than the diksha. So the siksha, is said in Shastra, is the most important aspect of the relationship. That's the most important. That's the ongoing. The diksha, it happens one time for an hour. But the ongoing is the siksha, the instruction. All the details of how to chant the mantras, how to engage in devotional service, how to do deity worship, everything. That's the siksha. So it's said, therefore, the siksha guru is most important. Now, as I said, for most devotees, their diksha guru is their siksha guru. So, but in some cases, no. Or in some cases, some devotees, for whatever reason, are attracted to hearing more from someone else, maybe more from Prabhupada. So Prabhupada becomes more prominent than their diksha guru in their life. Is there anything wrong with that? No, nothing. Because in the culture where you respect guru, you always respect guru. This is my guru, he saved me, he's my diksha guru, he took my karma, he's my, you know, that always remains. But now I'm taking instructions somewhere else. So they the Western mind will like be like this. The Eastern mind will be like this. You know, one doesn't obliviate the other, right? But for us, it's like, oh, now my diksha guru is down here because I have siksha guru. Or, you know, my siksha guru is good, but my diksha guru. You know. So you have, right? You have balance. And it's what my realization is, this really isn't even so much philosophy. This is just the nature of relationships. It's just allowing relationships to develop without getting mental. Like, what happens if I get attached to this person? Great. They're, you know, just like Urmila, she travels, she preaches, she's a woman. So maybe there are certain things you just need to hear from a woman. And she helps you in ways that a man can't, that your guru can't. And you get very attached. So is anything wrong with that? There's nothing wrong with it. Unless you think there's something wrong with it. You know what I mean? So it's a natural relationship. So she becomes a siksha guru. You write her letters, you get instruction. There's nothing wrong with it. See? It's just keep it natural and everything's fine. So, anyway, that was the answer to your question, that we didn't know that. And I think it was a response to Krishna Kirtan's statement, to become guru. Instruct everyone to follow the orders as they're given in Bhagavad Gita, and this will become spiritual master. Thanks for the good recalling. That was the pyramid talk at Shringananda's house. So what she's referring to is a little history here, is that, God, I want to give this history in another class because it's going to take a while, but I'll briefly give it. In May of 1977, you know, it seemed that Prabhupada's disappearance was imminent. We didn't know when. And the devotees of the GBC had never asked Prabhupada how initiations are going to go on after he leaves, because no one was thinking he was going to leave. So now, obviously, they're thinking, okay, he may leave. So when you leave, how do we do it? And Prabhupada said, he said, you will initiate, they'll be your disciples, and I'll name some of you. So everybody's clear, okay, he's going to name some, he's going to tell some of us. As I said last time, Prabhupada didn't want to name anybody because generally anybody can do it. Any disciple who's qualified can do it. So he was a little reluctant to name anybody. So he didn't name anybody, right? So then, in July, which is 2 months later, Tamal Krishna Maharaj, the Prabhupada's secretary, had 200 letters, initiation requests that were approved by temple presidents. And he didn't bring them to Prabhupada because he didn't want Prabhupada to get the karma because he was sick. So finally, he hit this point where he went to Prabhupada and said, what do I do with these letters? And Prabhupada said, all right, we'll appoint different devotees and they can do the initiations. So they'll choose the name, they'll chant on the beads, they'll do everything. And so Tamal Krishna said, And they'll do it on your behalf. They'll be your disciples. And Prabhupada said, yes, they'll be my disciples. And he said, is that called Ritvik? And Prabhupada said, yes, that's called Ritvik. So then he appointed. So-and-so could do, so-and-so could do, do. Different parts of the world. It was just by zone, basically GBC. You know, they'll do. And then they'll send the names and they'll be put in Prabhupada's book. So in May, he said, when I leave, you'll be guru, disciple of my disciple, regular guru. And then in July, he set up a Ritvik system, because he Prabhupada said, in the presence of the guru, you shouldn't initiate, unless he tells you. It's a formality. So this, they weren't initiating their disciples. He said, and after I go, then they'll initiate. So what Kamal Krishnamurti is saying is that we misunderstood that the 11 people Prabhupada appointed as Ritviks were the 11 only ones who would initiate after Prabhupada left. And in his lecture, he said, it was open for everybody. We misunderstood it was 11. We kept it restricted to 11. We should have just opened it up. That was the point he made. Now, the Ritviks, they quote that lecture as saying that Tamal Krishnamurti is saying Prabhupada just appointed Ritviks, which is what he said. He said, Prabhupada just appointed Ritviks. He didn't appoint gurus. And maybe this point may be debated, but we're just talking about what Tamal Krishnamurti's realization is. And his realization goes back to the point that Prabhupada did not want to appoint anyone as his successor or any group as his successor, because his real successor was the GBC. That's how he wanted the movement to run. So he was very careful about the GBC, but he didn't write any papers about this is how the succession is going to go on. And in fact, you could make the theory that if we didn't come and ask him, he wouldn't have said anything about it. Right? Because he didn't on his own. And why wouldn't he have said anything? Because he already said in his books, whoever is the next disciple. Now, who becomes the guru? Then whoever is this good disciple becomes the guru. I want you all to be guru. I'm training you to be guru. He already said it all. So he didn't really have to say it. But we just didn't understand that. So then they're coming to Prabhupada, who will be the guru? Who will be the guru? Who will be the guru? And he'll say, he didn't want to say. So he said, I'll appoint you. And as I'll appoint some. But he really didn't. He never actually appointed. I mean, that's what Tamal Krishnamurti was saying. He never appointed 11 people. He didn't appoint anybody. His Guru Maharaj never appointed anybody. He was focused on the GBC. That was what was going to keep the movement together. Guru's initiations is a private affair between two people. It's not an institutional affair. We made it an institutional affair by giving the GBC the sole right to initiate. So now you got a whole zone of just your disciples. So it became merged in management. So that created a problem. So his lecture, he said, Prabhupada never appointed any gurus. He only appointed 11 Ritviks to initiate on his behalf. And so the Ritviks say, see, he didn't appoint any gurus. He only appointed Ritviks. So that means he didn't want any gurus. And Prabhupada said, I'll choose some of you. And the Ritviks say, he never chose anybody, never told anybody. Now, Radha Govinda Maharaj came to Prabhupada with disciples to be initiated in, I think, maybe September of 1977. And Prabhupada said, in this condition, I don't want to initiate. You initiate them. And he wouldn't do it. He says, that can't be right that I initiate Prabhupada's present. And then he came back again with another devotee, with those same disciples. And Prabhupada said, I already told him to initiate those disciples. I will not take them. Another thing that Prabhupada told one of his servants, he gave his servant money for his child. He just had a baby. He said, Prabhupada, I can't take this money. He said, you're my spiritual master. I can't take the money. Prabhupada said, it's not for you. It's for your child. He said, I will not be the guru of your child. I'm not his spiritual master. I'm not going to be his Diksha guru. So Prabhupada already knew there are going to be other Diksha gurus. Where the Ritviks say, no, forever. Ritvik forever. So the fact that Prabhupada didn't appoint any gurus and he appointed Ritviks, the Ritviks were just representing him. But Prabhupada said, after I leave, you will become guru, disciple my disciple. Right? So he didn't really want to appoint, and he said, I'll appoint some of you. But he didn't want to appoint anybody. He just wanted GBC. Now, the argument, which is a really, really powerful argument that's made, is that if Prabhupada wanted to set up any kind of new initiation system, he would have talked about it. He would have written about it. He goes, this is how it's going to go. After I die, it's going to go like this. etc., you know, exactly like this. Now, they ask Prabhupada a question, after you go, some people will say, no, Prabhupada intended these 11 to be, these are Ritviks to be gurus. So we can even take that argument. Okay. Some people say, well, it was just natural they initiated because they were already doing it and they were advanced devotees. But even if you say Prabhupada intended those 11 to be gurus, but they also said, what about gurus in the future? And he said, and more can be added as needed. And then if you take that with the idea that it's open to all my disciples, there was really no restriction. And tomorrow Krishna was saying, no, we made a restriction. It was like there's 11, they didn't want to let more in because they had control of the movement. They thought, well, what if there's too many gurus? Then we won't have control. Then it became a whole managerial issue. But Prabhupada wanted the power of management to be with the GBC. Now the GBC is all gurus and all the power is held in a few people's hands. So it was a mess. So you may have to listen to this recording again to understand the whole history. But that's what Krishna Kirtan is referring to, that talk. Now, Prem Prashura says, I don't understand. In the previous classes, we talked about how we should not speak out against someone or protest and just wait. We should just wait. But it was due to the Godbrothers' protesting behavior of the Guru's system that there was change. Well, as I was saying, the fact that gurus fell down gave power to their arguments. So they were. We had to wait for that to happen. Because when it hit a certain number, then it was like, okay. Not only was our argument powerful, but what was happening is disciples of gurus in good standing were losing faith in their gurus. It was a mess. And, so we were building up disciples' faith by basically saying, this person's infallible, he's like Prabhupada. Right? And saying, as long as he represents Prabhupada, everything's good. But your faith has to be in Prabhupada and his instructions. You have to work with the GBC, you have to have faith in the GBC, guru may come and go. That was where it was going, and that's where it's going now in ISKCON. And it may have gone too far in ISKCON now, because it has to be balanced, because it's not like you minimize your relationship with your guru and just go, well, whatever GBC says, that's fine. Well, my guru says, whatever. But it's not that whatever the GBC says is not important. So there's a balance, which I want to talk about in further classes. So you have to leave. You can, if you want. No, okay. Because there's a lot of questions here. You want to sit in the chair? You can, if you're not comfortable.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, I'm describing this history, everybody sees history differently. So I'm also describing it through the eyes of people who have described it. So it's my point is, whether you say Prabhupada didn't want these Ritviks to initiate, or whether you say it was open to everybody, that's a moot point, because they initiated. So it doesn't matter, that's what they did. That's not the real issue. The real issue is how they should have done it and how it should have continued and how it should continue now. So Arish is saying, I listened to one lecture from an Indra. He said, our main job as devotees is to do Nam Sankirtan. Yes. You can chant all day while helping others, as Siksha Guru Indra was doing that. Yeah. I mean, yeah, it doesn't mean... So if anything coming in between as hindrance to do Nam Sankirtan, should we avoid, like book reading, any other service? No. Because it's all chanting. One time Prabhupada said, the devotees would go, in the early days, everybody would go on Sankirtan all day. But then we had people composing and transcribing and like that. So the transcribers were typing. And they could only go out maybe an hour a day, and everybody else would go for 8 hours. Or maybe they couldn't go out at all, and they wrote Prabhupada, and he said, your typing is chanting. So it's absolute. So the ultimate thing is you do the service your guru wants you to do and how best you can do it. You don't want to minimize Nam Sankirtan. That's the religion of the age. But sometimes other things are also chanting. And so one time Prabhupada wrote a letter and said, you should not see management as different from other service, because that service is necessary. So, oh, it's management, it's material, it's for people who just like to manipulate material energy. They don't like to chant. No. So you have to see that also, right? Because it's not, Prabhupada was doing a lot of things. He went to Vrindavan, and the whole time he was there, he was thinking about cement. because they couldn't get cement, because it was restricted by the government. So he was chanting cement. He wasn't chanting Hare Krishna sometimes. It was just as good, maybe even better in that case. Right? As Prabhupada said, you should do everything. You know, do the service that you're given, and don't minimize chanting. Andrew was also writing his book. He spent time preaching. Yeah, he did many things. He worshipped. He did Didi Puja worship, a lot of that. He chanted 64 rounds, I think. So it's all in Om Sankirtan. Prabhupada gave us many, many services. And when, for example, as book distribution was increasing in ISKCON, then Harinam was decreasing. And Prabhupada never said that this is bad. He gave more emphasis to book distribution. He said Harinam should go on. But he never said, no, these book distributors need to do Harinam all day. No. Distribute books more and more and more. And he knew those people doing book distribution were used to be doing Harinam. Now they're doing book distribution. So he never stopped them. So book distribution is Sankirtan. It is chanting the glories of the holy name in the written page. So it's the same thing. Written Sankirtan. Book Sankirtan. I think your question is a really good one to Prem Kishore. I struggle to understand the subtleties. These three had personal challenges. Yeah. Saying the three left had personal challenges, but one of the three had... The challenges were externally manifest. The others are still going on. So, you know, I mean, people could question, you know, that we all have challenges, we're all not perfect. Yeah. So that's the point. We're not perfect. And it's not that they're better than their God brothers. Right? Everybody's... You know. So now you see gurus, like Bhakti Charaswami. I was taking lunch with Bhakti Charaswami. He said, Guru in ISKCON is much different than it was in those days. You know, so it's like I walk around Mayapur. I think most people don't even know I have disciples. So it's like, you know, I'm just a Prabhupada disciple, but just, you know, so many Prabhupada disciples. It's like, whereas if this were like 1980, you know, and I was a guru, it's like, whoa. It's like a big thing. You know, there's a guru here, you know. So guru means he's a teacher or his disciple. So it's not like when I go to a temple, they have to say he's a guru, just like they don't have to say I'm a father. Right? It's a relationship. So, all right, I may have one disciple my whole life. That's it. Do I have some big position in ISKCON because I have one disciple? No, I can just be a nobody and have a disciple. I could have 100 disciples and still be a nobody. But I'm a somebody for those 100. But I could be a nobody for the other million people in ISKCON. Whereas in the early days, if you were a guru, you were a big somebody for everybody. And wherever you went, there had to be a big seat. They were building asanas as gurus would visit. So some temples had like 10 asanas. Because there were 10 gurus at one time. They had to have 10 asanas in their temple. So then it became like an institutional position rather than a relationship, right? So even if someday I have 5,000 disciples, I may be big guru in ISKCON, but it's just between me and the disciples. I'm not a guru for anybody else if they don't want me to be. It's just for them. So they bow down to me, Gurudev, you're the best thing that ever happened. You're so wonderful. Without you, I would be nowhere. But for everybody else, it's just Mahatma, yeah? Yeah, he's a nice devotee, whatever. Gives nice class, leads nice kirtan, you know, yeah, I'm inspired, I like his class. But that's about it. It's not anything more than that, right? Or maybe a little more than that, or a little less than that, right? Because it's subjective, it's relative. So we made it like, well, he's guru, so it's like, for everybody, he's got to be guru for everybody, in a sense. Doesn't have to be. You respect him, of course. Alright, this is all culture. Okay, where are we going here? Perfect conclusion, 5.5 says, one who can deliver dependence from the path, repeated birth and death, become spiritual master, father, is worshipable. One cannot deliver the dependence. Yeah, don't become a guru if you can't deliver your dependence. Or a husband, a mother, worshipable demigod, spiritual master, father. You know, you can add teacher, king, etc. But that description doesn't apply nowadays. I heard the mantra first from one devotee that is supposed to make him my diksha. No. Yeah, so Pollock's saying, he's like, when you get initiation, it's saying, you know, you get the mantra. But you already have the mantra. So it's saying it's formalizing that connection, because now you're vowing to chant 60 rounds. I already was chanting 60 rounds. It's just formalization. It's actually first initiation. It's already done. It's a formalization, a formalized connection. It's just, like Prabhupada said, it's just my touch. It's already there. It's just touch of formalization. Now you're sitting in my class. You've been coming like for 5 years to my class. You didn't get any credit. You got no credits on your card. Now you entered the university, you paid your fee, you're coming to my class, now you get credit. So just by formalizing it, now you get the credit. Now you're in the university system, you're part of it. So you're part of the family, officially within the disciplic succession. But other than that, everything else continues. The vows, the 16 rounds. The one who gives you the mantra, the one you first get the mantra is your Vartma Pradarshika Guru, the one who first led you on the path. And then the one who you take the initiation, the vows with, is your Diksha Guru. A lot of, Krishna Kirtan says, a lot of ISKCON gurus have so many disciples, they're not training them personally. That's a big part of ISKCON devotees. They need training and have no respect and submission for their uncles and aunties. That a big challenge still remains. Yeah, so that challenge is we're coming out of this culture of Diksha Guru is everything. So as we come out of the culture and you understand the importance of Diksha Gurus, and certainly the Diksha Gurus that have thousands of disciples know the importance of Diksha Gurus, because those are the people who have to train their disciples, because they can't do it themselves. Some gurus will not take a lot of disciples because they want to personally train them. So you have people who have been gurus for 20 years that have like 20 disciples or 30 disciples. That, you know, and if you want to take Diksha from them, you probably wait 5, 6, 7 years, because they want to make sure that they can train you and you can be trained and you're still around 7 years later. So you have that also. So you have both sides. You have, I think Mukunda Maharaj maybe has 100 disciples and he won't take any more. Borijan Prabhu maybe has 20 or 30 and he's been initiating for a long time. So you have that side of it also, the guru who just, and then you have the other side of the guru who will take thousands and thousands of disciples and work out systems for his disciples to be trained. Like we have the Bhakti Vriksha system. It's a system to bring people in and train them. The counselor system, mentor systems. Or zones itself set up systems to assist it. Like in England, they have very good training systems. So anyone who initiates disciples in England, even without doing anything, I think most of those disciples will get well trained just by the systems they have. Which is ideally the way it should be in ISKCON, that wherever you go, the local authorities make sure you're trained. Right? And then you realize that how much, I mean, I asked the temple president about this. I said, you know, you have disciples in your temple whose guru is Radhanaswami, and this temple is in Laguna Beach, and how often does Radhanaswami go to Laguna Beach? Like, I don't know if he's ever gone there, or if he goes, it's probably once every 3 or 4 years for a few days. So, yeah, of course, they can go, you know, when he's in America, they can go visit him. But the main point is, even if they go visit him, so that even if they go where he's staying, personal association won't be that much. So I said to him, I said, you're the one, it seems like you're the main one who's instructing these people, like you're really the guru. So what position does Radhanaswami really have as a Diksha Guru? Because it seems like you have most of the effect on their life. And he said, no, it's not actually like that. He said, I see it as synergistic, because Radhanaswami is their inspiration, their shelter, the person they have faith in. So even they're not getting instruction, that is going on constantly within their life, that I have this, here's this person who inspires me, who I have so much trust in and I just want to serve. And then the temple president, it makes it so much easier for him to help the devotees because they have that so much faith already, right? So he's giving the practical guidance day to day as their Siksha Guru, or they may not see him as Siksha Guru. But he couldn't be nearly as effective without that relationship with their Diksha Guru. And it's a decision of that disciple that they know, when I accept initiation from Radhanaswami, I know I'm not going to get a lot of personal time, if even any. Because he's traveling a lot and he has a lot of disciples, and I know if I take from Bhurijan Prabhu, I'll get personal guidance. And maybe too personal. Maybe he'll know too much, and I don't want that. Maybe I can't deal with that. He'll be going right into my heart, you know, doing surgery. So some people are actually more comfortable with a guru who has a lot of disciples and rather just get, you know, instruction locally. So they might feel it's too heavy. He'll expose too much or whatever. So that was this temple president's realization, that it works synergistically. And, you know, what's good for one may not be good for another. Because I've had people who wanted to take from me, and I said, why don't you take from Radhanaswami? I think it'd be better. And they'll say, no, I need a personal. I need somebody personal. I need someone who doesn't have a lot of disciples. And some others, I'll say, well, why aren't you taking from this one? They can give you personal guidance. He says, no, I'm so inspired by Radhanaswami. I just want to give my life to him. So everybody's different. But in either case, as Krishna Kirtan is saying, there has to be systems of being of training. Yeah, and a lot of these gurus do have systems, or they won't initiate somebody unless they know they're being taken care of locally. Like, where you live, who's taking care of you? I want to know. If I can't take care of you, who's taking care of you? Right? So if you have a lot of disciples, that's an issue. If you have 10 disciples, it's not much of an issue to take care of 10. But if you have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, you have to know who's going to take care of you. Even for myself, even like maybe between Siksha and Diksha, there's like 40. Even that, to take care of everybody, I can't even do that. They need guidance locally on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, if they go off and they don't write me, how do I know? So even a small number is hard to take care of unless you're working with them very closely. Okay. Then, Krishna, how will the Siksha Guru be stressed in ISKCON? It's through education, through the guru stressing it, through classes, and most importantly, through its manifestation in the culture. And I would say, my realization and my point is that, and I made this point before, there are a lot of natural relationships in ISKCON, and they need to be allowed to be natural. And as long as we're natural, the relationships will develop. And you won't feel guilty about having these really close relationships with Siksha Gurus. And they'll develop naturally, as long as you don't feel guilty. You know. And I think you can trace back a lot of problems in ISKCON to us in some way interfering with relationships. Like in the zonal guru days, if you didn't want to take initiation from the local guru, you would be asked to leave, you would be pressured to take, you'd be made to feel guilty, or you would be allowed to take from the other, but you'd be made to feel like, you know, that wasn't really the best decision, because you should just take from him. So there was no natural development of relationship. It was like the relationship was developed for you. It was like you join the zone, here's the guru, and you just get into it. And so therefore, there were no other relationships that would develop, even if they could be natural. Or as I said with God Brothers, that we're helping you become a devotee, that relationship would just kind of dissolve. And another point that happens, that's still presently in ISKCON will happen, is you'll find somebody, they say, I want you to be my Diksha Guru, and later on they'll change their mind and they'll pick another Diksha Guru, and then that relationship with their former Diksha Guru is just, it's gone. But it shouldn't be that way. That person is still your Siksha Guru. But because we're so much focused on the Diksha, we'll think, well, whoever the Diksha, that's the person. You know. But I had this, like, guidance and relationship with this other Diksha Guru. So that should continue. Why not? You don't just, okay, Guru Maharaj, you know, I've got a new guru. I'm dumping you, see you later, you know, I mean, maybe I'll see you sometime, maybe we'll talk, but you know, it shouldn't be that way. That you take guidance from as many people as possible, wherever you can. So if you change your mind, or as I say, sometimes after you're initiated, you change your mind in the sense you don't change your mind, but you become connected to some other guru, more closely than your guru, because your guru, maybe you have no access to. Or maybe you just think differently. You're so aligned with the way this other guru thinks. It's not a problem. It's only a problem when people tell you it's a problem and make you feel bad. It's natural. It's normal. You have a teacher, right? Can you think of a teacher in school who just like changed your life more than your father, your mother? I can. That happened with Prabhupada, for sure, right? So this teacher, like, he, you know, but he's not your father, or she's not your mother. She can't replace your father and mother. But they did things your father and mother didn't do. You just, it's not a, you don't feel guilty, you just acknowledge it. Yeah, he enlightened me about what I should do with my life, that my father and mother never did. But my father and mother gave me love, they gave me food, they gave me guidance in this way and that way. So they all had different functions. So you love them both in their own way. We weren't allowing that natural relationship to develop. So if you just allow it to be natural, yeah, we all have to become sahajya, as Krishna Kirtan. Sahajya means natural. Become natural in that sense, of just allowing relationships to develop naturally, then you won't have this problem. You know? We like philosophize relationships. We philosophize ourselves out of relationships by making ourselves feel guilty, and so we're preventing, right? Right? Like I was telling some boys here, they were used to be Ritviks, and I say, one of the big problems I see with Ritviks is if you're a Ritvik, you cannot develop a really deep relationship with anybody as a Siksha disciple. Because if it develops very deeply, it's because you've been taught to see only Prabhupada as the guru. And you can't really see these other people as guru. And they agreed. They said, yeah, that's completely true. So the natural relationship that could develop very closely, even if it's not Diksha, as a Siksha disciple, humbly serving this person, it won't, because you're focused on Prabhupada as the guru. Prabhupada is the guru. Nobody can be the guru but Prabhupada. Nobody on that level. So even the relationship could develop, it will never develop. And they said, yeah, it's true. So, it, you know, Ritvik philosophy, a philosophy is destroying a relationship, right? That's the way I see it. It's just, these things are natural. There's nothing wrong. It's good. Become attached to devotees. It's good. The more, the better, you know? If Belen writes me and says, oh, Mother Urmila came to Argentina and I developed this really attachment for her, you know, and she's really helping me. She helped me realize so many things and problems I was having, and it's so good. What am I supposed to say? Oh, you shouldn't have done that. That's really bad. You didn't ask me. You know. No, I'll say, that's wonderful. I'm so happy that she's helping you. You know, she's such a wonderful devotee. She's so intelligent. She's so empowered. I have so much respect for her. She's a dear disciple of Prabhupada. You're so fortunate. That's how I feel. Because that's not, why should I feel any other way? That's a natural way to feel. But if I philosophize that, no, I'm your guru, she's not your guru, then, you know, she shouldn't be doing that and you shouldn't be hearing. Then it's like taking a natural relationship and everybody feels bad about it. But otherwise, everyone, of course, would feel good about it because it's good. Oh, I went to so-and-so's house and they fed me. They shouldn't have done that. You didn't ask me if they could feed you. That's not good. You know, your mother's upset that your aunt fed you. You know, you're supposed to come home for dinner, but you stayed at your aunt's house and she fed you. Of course. See, so that's what was happening. It's just like, so that's my objective, and that's why I object about the resistance to let females become Diksha Guru, because it's inhibiting natural relations. The relationship is there. Don't philosophize yourself out of a relationship. It's unhealthy, in my opinion. And I think history shows us that it's unhealthy. The Mitra system is not like the Siksha Guru. My experience in many of Radhanath Swami's disciples are not satisfied with their Mitra. They're acting really as Siksha Guru for most of them. They're quite immature. Yeah, that's true. So what Krishna Kirtan is saying is that they have a system, like a counselor system, with Radhanath Swami disciples, but she's saying that those disciples are not him. So they're not... they're not getting the same siksha that they would get from him if he could personally take care of them. That's true. I don't know. I mean, I've observed that myself. I don't know the satisfaction or dissatisfaction that they're at, but I have helped his disciples deal with personal problems that I have, I feel I have some special insight Krishna gave me, and they're not problems that many devotees would know how to deal with anyway. So you have that also, that even sometimes the gurus can't deal with certain problems. They're so deep. So that's a whole issue of discussion. But Prabhupada said, each of you make 5,000-10,000 disciples. So I go back to the point that the structure within ISKCON should be able to deal with that better, because some gurus will have a lot of disciples. And there's been no resolution that I've seen on the GBC to limit the number of disciples, which I don't think is a bad idea personally. But it may not be practical, and there may not be enough people to initiate that everybody could, limit at 100. 100 you can take care of. So I don't have an answer for that, because he's making that decision and I don't know enough about it. But definitely we can see the advantage of a guru having lesser numbers of disciples, because he can deal with them personally. We can also see the advantage of having really good, strong temples and congregations, because those local devotees can deal with them. So many are not advancing really with the Mitra system. They don't really trust their god brothers and god sisters. It would take the guru to trust his own. Yeah, I mean, another example, through education, VIG, MIG, that would require the Diksha guru to be free from envy of. Yeah, yes. And another possible thing that I thought of that I don't see happening that much is that god brothers could ask other god brothers to come in and help them within their zone. Actually, one god brother asked me. He said, this guru has so many disciples, I think it would be good if you lived in his zone and you helped his disciples. You became like the six-year guru, because he can't take care of them. So that was already in some devotees' minds. But I've never seen it practically. Or maybe gurus are trying to do that and they just can't get enough god brothers who are free to be able to do that. But I always thought the gurus needed help from day one. I never thought they should do it alone. So what you're saying, Krishna Kirtan, just shows the difficulty in one guru trying to do that without the help of other god brothers. So now that ends. We have ended. That ends. Class is over, and it's been 1 hour and 45 minutes, and I have to leave at 9:30 to go to Calcutta. Is that okay?
Yes.
If we go at any more questions at all,
yes,
this I have so much more to talk about on this topic. And like Krishna Kirtan is saying, well, what are we doing about this? Well, one of the things that I will try to do, and you can help me do this, is I'm recording all these, and I think these discussions, this history, is very important for devotees to hear. So I was initially doing this for all of you who want to listen to this, because I felt this is so important. But in talking about these things, I realize how this really needs to get out there. So even these lectures are all being put up on my YouTube channel, and if there are other ways to get this out, you can tell other people, you can put it on Facebook, direct them, and just it's really important that devotees hear this. And that's all we can do, is just more people have to hear it, talk about it, tell other people. If you're talking to someone and you hear them say things that reflect a misunderstanding, you could say, well, I attended this class and we discussed this. And I think that point about natural relationships is really, it's really the essence. Because I saw so many natural relationships getting stifled because of it was all Diksha Guru. And at one point in my life, I decided I would never be a Diksha Guru, because I had Siksha disciples, and I felt if someone approaches me as a Siksha disciple, it must be real, because they don't have to. There's nothing that says you have to do this, because it could be a six-year relationship, could be for 1 week, and it could be on any level. It could just be, you're teaching me mridanga. When I learn mridanga, it's over. Or as I said, it could be lifelong. And I felt more comfortable with that because I felt it was real. Because if it's your Diksha Guru, there's a certain protocol and a certain way that you have to be. And I'm not saying that people aren't naturally that way. In most cases, they are. But I felt a reluctance because I kind of saw in some cases people weren't, but they were acting externally that way. You know, Guru Maharaj, this, that, and that. And when Guru Maharaj would go, they would just fall into Maya. So I felt it was just more protocol, it wasn't real, and I wanted to be in real relationships. And I felt, well, if I never accept you as a Diksha disciple, then whatever affection and service and relationship we have, you're doing it because you want to, you don't have to. Anyway, I surrendered to being Diksha Guru, but that was my feeling for many years. I wanted to make sure it was genuine. And the climate in ISKCON was such that if someone accepted me as a Diksha Guru, then they would have just been all Guru Maharaj, this and that, just because they had to, and everybody else was doing it, and pressure to do it. And I don't think it's so much like that now, but I didn't want that kind of relationship. That makes me feel weird. You know what I mean? I'm from California, so. You know, we're pretty laid back in California. So, you know, you want things real. Of course, in Indian culture, you know, if it's not real, it's okay, because there's protocol and etiquette, and I understand that. So I'm just saying, personally, like Jamal Krishna Raj said, he had a Vyas Puja, and there was a ceremony, and the one devotee just expressed everything completely from her heart, just total emotion. And of course, other people expressed, you know, you're my guru, and then went to the Shastra, the guru is this, Sakshat Hari, you know. And afterwards he said, I guess he said to my wife, or my wife told me, that he said that that devotee that expressed the emotions, that was the best offering. That was the one I appreciated the most. Because it was about relationship. And guru-disciple is relationship. Everything's about relationship, right? So you don't want protocol to replace relationship. Relationship is the essence. Protocol has to be there, of course. Etiquette has to be there. But relationship's most important. Hopefully... please ask your disciples to make booklets with these discussions as His Holiness Gaur Govinda Swami's disciples are doing. Yeah. So someone could transcribe these. Well, somebody... there's a devotee who's willing to transcribe. Should I give it to her? She'll take a long time, but she'll do it. Okay, I'll make a note of that. That's a good idea. I'll have to have some God brothers read it before I let it loose on the world, because... make sure that I didn't say anything wrong. For which, I'll be blasted on the internet. Yes, thank you. Okay. So Guru Nisha, just make sure you put these classes up as you get them, and put links on Facebook, and everybody else can link it on their Facebook or whatever. So it's really important, I think. Yes? Okay?
Yes.
All right, so we're going to go.